Hello and welcome to the Humans and Events Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello. Is it me you're looking for?
Lionel Richie.
Lionel Burney.
Lionel Richie.
Gee whiz, what a great start to 2014. Welcome to 2014. This is our first podcast. Daniel's got the year off to a very odd start already. But we've got a packed first show, haven't we, looking ahead to the season?
We have. We're going to set the tone for 2014. Packed year of cycling podcast weekly through the early season, through the classics, the Giro d'Italia, and then daily during the Tour de France.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
All right, fellas, the season has started. We're a couple of days into the new season. Argentina, Tour de San Luis, and the Tour Down Under in Australia will be kind of overtaken by events there, but Simon Gerrans is off to a flyer in Australia. Young Phil Gaimon, or not-so-young Phil Gaimon in Argentina for Garmin Sharp, won the first stage there and is in the leader's jersey as I speak. He's quite an interesting chap. But Daniel, you were talking a bit about Tour de San Luis. This is a new race, as far as we're aware, in the last couple of years, and it's been getting a stronger and stronger field every year. This year in particular, it's a very strong field there. Can you tell us a little bit about how, you know, where's this race come from? Who's behind it?
Well, it is actually quite a cycling hotbed, that particular region of Argentina, and I think I'm correct in saying that the Currochet family, there's a great of track cycling dynasty, the Currochet family, I think hail from that region, and Giovanni Lombardi, who's the old Italian lead-out man slash sprinter, famous for being Mario Cipollini's lead-out man for several years, and then sort of morphed into a domestique for notably CSE, I think. He was always a good friend of, I think, Gabriel Currochet, who is the most decorated member of that family, and forged, obviously, a good connection there. Lombardi was behind the failed bid and the rather shambolic bid to try to naturalise Davide Rebellin as an Argentine citizen in 2004. And has now...
Because Rebellin never, he just never got selected.
No, I remember I was at that press conference, and there was a press conference where he was unveiled as an Argentine, I think the night before, or two nights before the World Championships in Verona in 2004, because he wasn't going to get selected for the Italian team, and then it all got called off at the last minute. Sort of typical kind of tragicomic cycling story, really. And Lombardi has now built up this race, the Tour de San Luis.
And it's his contacts clearly that have allowed the strong European.
Yeah, there's a lot of Italian media there in particular. He's from very early on, he got some very strong Italian riders riding there. Nibali, I think, has been for the last two or three years. He's certainly there at the moment. It's a race that
Cavendish
is going well over there. Yeah, so it seems to be going from strength to strength.
Argentina, I mean, we all know all about Colombian cycling, but Argentine cycling is a bit of a hotbed, but we don't really know much about it. There are more velodromes in Argentina than any other country in the world, apparently.
Yeah, they've been strong mainly on the track. I mean, there are a few Argentine, fairly tenuous Argentine road cycling connections for Juan Antonio Fletcher.
Yeah. Lucien Petit-Breton, is he not raised in Argentina originally? We're going back to 1908 there. I'll check that out, but I'm pretty sure. What do you know about Argentine cycling?
Well, Currochet is the big one. He was the guy. He won a medal at the Beijing Olympics, didn't he? Pretty much stopping the
Madison.
No? Yeah, they were the guys that were sort of. They stopped the British sort of dominance on the track. Cavendish and Wiggins were in that race, and it was the Currochet brothers. I think, is that right? Oh well, no,
Riquette, you think?
No, it was Currochet and Walter Perez, wasn't it? We'd better check this before rambling on.
Well, I'm checking Lucien Petit-Breton. He did indeed move from Brittany to Argentina, Buenos Aires, at the age of six, and he was the 1908 Tour de France winner. I knew it from somewhere.
So Argentina's rich,
rich cycling heritage.
One thing that is interesting about the Argentine riders who have come over, the road riders, they've tended to be sprinters rather than the rest of South America, obviously known for its climbers. There've been a few in minor Italian teams, Ruben Bongiorno,
Great name.
I think the Riquetti brothers, and they've tended to ride for what is now the Bardiani team.
But given the very strong links between Argentina and Europe, it's strange that there isn't perhaps more of a road cycling culture there. Perhaps Tour de San Luis will build that. The other race that's going on at the moment is Tour Down Under. Any of you guys been to Tour Down Under before?
No, I haven't, no.
I've been there a couple of times. I went there 2009 and 2010. 2009 for the Lance Armstrong comeback, which was the main story in town. And it's a very low-key race where riders and teams are, you can tell they're very much at different stages of their preparation for the season. I remember bumping into Remy De Gregorio coming back to the hotel looking rather the worse for wear at about 4 o'clock in the morning one evening. I was fine. There's no comment on me whatsoever there, but it's quite interesting just to see the different. And I think that's changed in the last few years. That you know, whereas teams would have perhaps, or riders would have perhaps looked on Australia as a very low key, relaxed race where they can let their hair down. I think there's more of a kind of competitive air about it.
There's always someone there that gets an absolute kicking. It's where there's always someone who gets found out. I seem to remember. I think it was one of the Capel brothers.
Well.
No, I think one of the Belgian, Ludovic Capel, maybe, about 10 years ago, he turned up about 35 kilos overweight, and I think was outside the time limit in the first stage.
But now it's a World Tour race. I don't think those days are gone. Simon Gerrans looks to be in terrific form. He's already Australian national champion, and he beat Andre Greipel in a sprint yesterday. You know, surprised there, it was quite a tough stage, I think, and perhaps a bit surprised that Greipel was even there at the finish, so perhaps his second place shouldn't be too frowned upon. But Gerrans is looking in terrific form already.
The Tour Down Under is obviously now it's a World Tour race. It has got an important slot on the calendar. It's the first major event of the season. It's possible for us here in the UK to watch it if we want to. If we've got Sky TV and want to stay up through the night, although they do sort of show it again during the day, so it's possible to keep tabs on what's going on. But there is a sort of a slightly disproportionate level of importance attached to it because it's the first time we see that some of the major riders in action in the new year. There's always the excitement of seeing people in their new team jerseys. But in terms of a sort of sporting contest and the implications and impact it has on particularly the spring season for people, going from high 30s heat and I think 40 degree heat, and I mean so hot there were even bushfires that threatened to cancel the opening stage, coming back then to a Europe which increasingly in recent years has had a very cold February, March and even April, there's a real kind of shock to the system, and you do wonder whether the balance of how the cycling season is structured is going to remain as it is now, and whether there will become almost like a sort of an Australasian swing at some point, which maybe would start in November and run through December and January, which would make more sense particularly as the races in the sort of traditional European heartland, the races in February and even March are really struggling to maintain a foothold in terms of importance.
Mm. You say, I mean, I thought you were sort of suggesting that what goes on at Tour Down Under has very little bearing or relevance on the rest of the year, or?
Well, it's difficult when you're running up to the classics. It's difficult to say, you know, Simon Gerrans, former Milan-San Remo winner, he's obviously banging form early on, but I think as we were saying before, it's very hard to gauge at what stage each rider is at. Are they coming up? Are they peaking for this and targeting it? What position does it really hold on the calendar in terms of importance? Obviously, for the people who win, you know, it's an important race win on their palmares, but it still doesn't strike me as having the level of kind of prestige
kudos of the
races that are to come. Which
you know, there are these sort of historic stage races, as you mentioned, still to come. Pyrenees and Tirreno Adriatico, which we'll maybe talk about a bit later. I was, you know, mentioning the Tour Down Under 2010. That was the race where Peter Sagan first kind of announced himself, even in the crit, actually, on the eve of the race, where he got in a break with Lance Armstrong, and he was 19, I think, at the time, and that was the first time we'd ever been aware of him. And I remember the stage the queen stage of the Tour Down Under. He got away with Valverde, Cadel Evans and Luis Leon Sanchez, I think, who won the stage. And it was the four of those riders, and he thought, wow, this kid is really quite special, and he proved it the rest of the year. So that race did sort of unearth Peter Sagan, which is, you know, so perhaps it can serve that kind of purpose.
Yeah, I think the purpose it serves for a lot of teams is that the second, generally teams will have two training camps, one before Christmas, one after Christmas. The second one in January always used to be the key one for most teams, and I think the Tour de San Luis and the Tour Down Under together have almost negated the need for a big sort of fully fledged second training camp for a lot of teams. In fact, there are some teams who aren't really having a second training camp this year because they've got, you know, between those two races they've got 20 riders away.
The other thing is that looking at the size of the crowds at the Tour Down Under and the amount of media coverage it gets there in what is a hugely important market, while we have the business model which relies on sponsor fan engagement, the Tour Down Under is presumably much more appealing to sponsors than Paris-Nice or Tirreno-Adriatico, where you can go 100 kilometres without seeing any spectators on the roadside on some stages. And so, you know, having the Tour Down Under, it starts and finishes more or less in the same place each, or it doesn't finish in the same place each day, but it's based in Adelaide for the whole week. They're the real, I imagine, a real sort of festival atmosphere. It's almost the blueprint for the modern stage race. Mm. So you could kind of see becoming more common in the future. You know, we could debate whether
that's why the riders love it. There's no travel.
Whether the idea of point to point stage races that travel 1,000 kilometres in one direction over the course of a week, whether that is actually going to be sustainable over the next few years.
It's actually interesting that you look at the new sort of breed of stage races that have come along, the Qatars, the Amans, the Dubai, which will start this year, and then the Tour Down Under. They've kind of lost that element of a race completing a kind of geographical journey. If you look at, you know, Paris-Nice is famous, the race to the sun. Tirreno-Adriatico, it's the race between two seas. And, you know, that was always seen as a key component of, you know,
back to the having to take the race to the people. That was the only way you could take the race to the people, whereas now the big audience is TV rather than the roadside. Yeah. So perhaps the modern, as you say, the modern stage race is one that where it almost doesn't have to embark on a journey. It can be in the same place.
Yeah, I mean, and I think as we might have mentioned it on the podcast before, Rich, but I think I remember telling you, I asked Rod Ellingworth, the Team Sky race coach, about his first experience at the Tour of Oman a couple of years ago, because, you know, we all see the pictures of Oman, it looks very scenic, it looks quite appealing. I said, so Rod, how was it? He said, well, tarmac road, wasn't it? And that was all he had to say about it.
I think, something that's kind of shocked me a little bit about that Jonathan Vaughter said to me probably 3 or 4 years ago when we were debating the likely redesign and repackaging of particularly stage racing. He said something that really sort of jolted. He said, if you want to talk about dying races, it is Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico, simply because of the complete lack of spectator engagement. You may well be fascinated by the tactical battle on the road, but for a TV audience, if nobody's there watching, subconsciously the TV viewer thinks, if nobody's there watching, why should I be watching?
And in Adelaide at the Tour Down Under, it's probably the same crowd every day.
Yeah, and both races, Tirreno and Paris-Nice, are on life support. They're being run as loss leaders by ASO and RCS, and Tirreno is in a lot of trouble, in fact.
And having those stipulations, Paris-Nice doesn't really start in Paris anymore, but they're quite restricting as well, having to go from one place to another.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
So transfer news. We didn't really talk about this at the end of last year, so let's talk about some of the transfers for this season. The new riders and new kit, the likes of Rui Costa, Lampre Merida, Mark Renshaw, Omega Pharma quick set back with Mark Cavendish, Rigoberto Urán to Omega Pharma, Sylvain Chavanel. Let's start with Chavanel, who's moved from Omega Pharma to IAM Cycling, the Swiss team, which started up last year an ambitious team with potentially lots of money and quite a stylish kit. What do you make of that? They're really stepping up this year, and they're aiming obviously for the Tour de France, which you'd have thought they'd have a good chance of getting a wild card for the Tour with Chavanel in the team. Puts them on a kind of level footing with maybe, you know, a lower French team, perhaps a Cofidis or somebody like that. It's a big opportunity for them this year, isn't it?
He's a strange rider in the sense that I don't think he's ever particularly thrived when he's been the sole leader of a team. You know, you've seen glimmers of his talent, and he has quite unusual characteristics. He's extremely powerful, fantastic ruler, not a particularly good sprinter, not a fantastic climber. And his best results have always tended to come from long breaks, 30, 40, 50 kilometres from the finish. And I just thought that Quickstep, and this was proven by his results, Quickstep was the best place for him. You know, he's put on some fantastic displays in the classics, particularly the Tour of Flanders, for the last few years, and it's tended to be as the kind of the decoy rider or the guy who's kind of softened up the other favourites for then usually Boonen to come through in the last 15-20 kilometres. So there'll be a lot more pressure on him at I Am Cycling. I mean, there are other riders to bear some of the responsibility there, like Heinrich Hausler. I think Jérôme Pinot, another Quickstep rider who's gone with Chavanel, he's a great friend. I think he's probably passed offering a viable alternative at I Am Cycling. But it's an interesting one, and again, with them, there's a big question mark over their race programme. You know, they're trying to get into major tours, and they'll be looking for starts in a lot of the semi-classics, classics, which obviously Chavanel's going to rely on.
It was 2011 Tour of Flanders, wasn't it, where Nick Noyens won the race, but Chavanel, who'd been away all day, did come pretty close to winning that. And as you say, I think benefited enormously from the fact that everybody was looking at Boonen and his teammate. And as you say, taking on that mantle of outright leadership is a different scenario altogether, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a big paycheck, to be honest, at I Am Cycling. Quickstep are quite... They've got a huge budget, but they might be quite stretched with Cavendish and Uran joining, and obviously Boonen still there, and various other sort of high-end riders.
But it's funny because maybe it's because he's French, but he has a profile as a kind of leader. He's a sort of an A-list bike rider, isn't he? Without perhaps the palmarès to back that up. I mean, he's worn the yellow jersey. He's won at least a couple of stages of the tour. But perhaps doesn't actually really have the, especially in the classics and things like that, you know, second place in Tour Flanders is the outstanding.
Yeah, and he's never really achieved a result kind of, I hesitate to say that he's never achieved a result sort of a la pedal, but he has never been in an elite group at the end of a classic or a major one-day race and out-sprinted or, you know, out-ridden other major contenders. It has been... it has tended to be these sort of long-range attacks.
He's won three stages of the Tour, actually, checking my records here.
Yeah.
I always remember an anecdote that Bradley Wiggins gave us. There was a stage of the Tour where he was seventh on the climb to Alpe d'Huez, which shows, again, what a versatile rider he is, what an all-rounder. I think it might have been the stage that Frank Schleck won a few years ago. And just an anecdote from Wiggins that Chavanel had a blood test that morning and his hematocrit was 39. Now, I think it was the third week of the Tour, so you'd expect him to be depleted, but I think that was quite a moment for Wiggins to realise that this magic number wasn't perhaps the be-all and end-all, and it was a pretty gutsy ride that day. Lionel, any other transfers that catch your eye?
Well, Rigoberto Urán from Sky to Amica Pharma Quickstep is probably one of the more intriguing changes. You know, Urán has made himself into a very valuable asset, and Amica Pharma, previously Quickstep, their kind of on-off relationship with Grand Tours. The last few years they've kind of ignored the overall classification, but there's something about Patrick Lefebvre, the team owner, boss, he can't quite leave it alone. This goes all the way back to the Mapai days, doesn't it, when they were dominant. Well, you know, they did have Tonkov for a while, Pavel Tonkov.
Rominger even.
You know, they had
Garzelli.
They were always trying to do everything, weren't they?
But they've had over the years, you know, people who were really hotly tipped to be sort of, if not Grand Tour riders, certainly stage race riders. I'm thinking of Pekka Roman, the Spaniard, who was kind of hailed as this. He was going to be the next big thing.
And Mercado,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ruhano.
Yeah, Ruhano. I mean,
it tends to be Hispanic as well.
And you think somebody comes along, shows a good deal of promise, and then takes the quick step. The quick step quid, and then it all just falls apart. And even Michael Rogers, you know, who was there at a time when he was kind of young, up and coming, feeling his way in week-long stage races, won a couple maybe, but he was kind of always put to work for Vironk instead. And so now Uran just represents Lefebvre's latest throw of the dice when it comes to trying to get on the podium of a Grand Tour, and it could go either way. I mean, at the moment there's this sort of interesting battle between Uran and Cavendish over who gets the sort of top billing at the Tour de France, and Cavendish will no doubt argue that his effectiveness will be compromised if you have to send a couple of helpers for Uran for the mountains. And Uran, who rode the Giro and kind of got on the podium almost by default, because Wiggins pulled out, and Uran just rose up, obviously a good distance behind Nibali, but certainly the best of the rest. It's a case of whether Amiga Farmer can persuade Uran to target the Giro, and you could almost see a battle between Uran and Henao Sky for the Giro, perhaps, or even Uran and Quintana, because we don't yet know whether Quintana will do the Giro or the Tour.
The relationship between Uran and Cavendish is interesting, and I asked Mark about that in the interview that we played on the podcast end of last year. But Daniel, you know a little bit about Mark's relationship with Uran when they were at Sky together. I think it wasn't always a happy camp.
Yeah, I mean, there was a bit of a kind of flare-up at the Giro in 2012 where Cavendish just got frustrated with the Colombian style of riding. He said that they would switch off in the middle of, you know, I suppose the transitional stages, and they would expect to kind of flicker into life in the last 2 hours of stages. And, you know, Cavendish had a bit of a battle to get them to concentrate, because often they would, you know, they would end up behind crashes, and someone, you know, an Ian Stannard or I think Geraint Thomas was riding that Giro, would have to go back and kind of fetch them and pace them back up to the bunch. So I think it was a bit of just a conflict of kind of racing cultures there. And I think they kind of got on okay at the end, and I think it's okay now. But there's an interesting mix of ingredients in that team, because another sort of fault line in that team could be, I think, the old HTC Alliance management level, which is Al Dagenholm and the kind of Belgian old school, which has really controlled that team for a long time, which is Lefebvre and Wilfred Peters. And, you know, Cavendish has been frustrated since he joined, slightly frustrated with the just how the classics really monopolise Peters and Lefebvre's, to a certain extent, attention. That'll be an interesting issue as well this year. I know there's been a lot. There've been talks over the winter about how to be slightly more harmonious, but I think Aldag, to a certain extent, there will be part of him that will balk slightly at the idea of splitting the team and hedging their bets, which is exactly what they didn't do at HTC, and that was why they were so effective. Exactly. That they realised that the best way to get a lot of attention, to get a lot of success at the major tours, was to focus everything on Cavendish and everything on time trials, which is what they were good at. But as soon as you go in with the team split between three or four different objectives, then it starts to become more difficult. And we've got Boonen as well to throw into the mix, who wants to do the Tour de France, wants to win the stage, the Paris-Roubaix
kind stage, of. Yeah.
I think culturally, the interesting thing with the really international teams, Sky are one, Amiga Farmer, Quickstep are another, blending all of these, not just different riding styles, but different cultures as well. People brought up in a very different style of cycling. I mean, if you think back to the 80s when the Colombians kind of first arrived, they basically had their own team pretty quickly. Café de Colombia sponsored one, Postobon was another.
Barta originally.
Barta, the first one. Was the first one. And you know, they anecdotally, they were treated pretty shoddily by the established European riders. I mean, Sean Kelly kind of jokes about it now and says that the Colombians' reactions were 3.5 seconds slower than everybody else's, and that if there was a crash, there'd be a Colombian at the bottom of the pile because they didn't have the bike handling skills ride in the
some research on Lucho Herrera, and I just did an interview with him recently, actually, and he was the first sort of major stage winner at Alpe d'Huez in 1984. And part of the problem, they were blamed for all the crashes, as you say. They were also blamed, though, by other team directors. I found some very scathing comments from Peter Post at the time, talking about the fact that they didn't participate in the racing, other than at the mountain stages. And this was a real frustration, especially to those Northern Europeans, the Dutch teams, the Belgian teams, who like to organise things at the front. And the Colombians just wouldn't take part in that at all. They weren't used to that style of racing. So they were riding at the back all the time, which inevitably meant they were caught up in more crashes. And perhaps because they were caught up in more crashes, they got the blame for them, which was probably unfair. But they were always waiting for the mountains. But it was interesting to go back and just see how that Colombian cycling culture goes all the way back.
I don't think that's really changed. I mean, I remember talking to Stef Clement, a Dutch rider, mostly specialised as a time trialist, but he rode for a few years with Bouygues Telecom. And I asked him about his experience of riding as a Dutchman in a French team, which is kind of a fairly uncommon mix. Not many foreign riders go to French teams, but if they do, they tend to perhaps be, you know, Scandinavian or Australian or whatever. So a Dutchman in a French team was something slightly unusual. And he said that one of the things he couldn't get his head around was how unpopular Bouygues Telecom were, particularly with sort of Rabobank and the Belgian teams. For that very reason, Bouygues Telecom never did any work in the bunch. They were never on the front, they never assumed control of the peloton. And the bunch is a society on wheels, isn't it? And everyone has to kind of play their part. And if you've got teams that have a reputation for never really getting involved and doing the grunt work, but are always pinging off up the road and trying to get in breaks.
Yeah,
and
I mean, that's the thing that annoys other riders more than
very unpopular quickly. Yeah. And so when you go back to Daniel, your example of Cavendish and Uran, you know, Cavendish is a rider who will always try and keep himself out of trouble first, but he also expects that kind of shield of support to help him. And if two of his Colombian teammates are down the back, kind of sitting last 10, which often they do, you know, that's not the way he sees that those stages to be raced. So
it's for Cavendish, the race starts when the race starts, isn't it? And he wants people to be switched on the whole time.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
On that, Rich, about Uran and the possibility of him riding the Giro, I mean, it's a fantastic opportunity, probably a unique opportunity this year at the Giro, because I think the field is going to be quite poor in terms of the general classification. And, you know, I remember Johan Bruneel saying a few years ago that everyone knew that Uran was by far the biggest talent in the world as far as stage racing was concerned. I'm not really sure he's lived up to that billing, but if he ever is going to win a Grand Tour, I think it could be at the Giro this year, because you look, you know, Henao might do it, Quintana might do it. But otherwise, you know, you're looking at guys like Scarponi and all the
Richie Port as well.
Richie Port, or the prospect of a rider coming from, you know, perhaps a young rider, perhaps Fabio Aru for the Astana team, coming from absolutely nowhere. But on paper, it's not a particularly strong race this year.
Do you think that's why there's been so much talk that Quintana will end up going there, even though, just sort of reading between the lines, it looks like you could hypothesise that perhaps the Giro have offered a fair bit of appearance money and Movistar are keen to take that, but Quintana wants to go to the Tour because, having finished second there...
Of course, he can do both, can't he?
He can, but tends to compromise people, doesn't it?
Is that right? They have been offered a lot of appearance money for Quintana?
I would suspect that could be true. I mean, whether it's money or whether it's other... You know,
remember, they
incentives.
Paid a lot for Armstrong, didn't they?
Yeah.
To ride the Giro in 2009, but... Is that something the Giro does as a matter of course? Is it?
Yeah,
they
would
a lot
do
of
that.
Appearance fees. So Wiggins last year would have got some money for riding the Giro, perhaps, you think?
That's possible. I think they find they need to do that more and more. I mean, it's in a bit of an invidious position, especially this year, the Giro, because I think the field is going to be weak, and I think there is a danger of it losing its foothold even more than it has in the last few years, and the Italian interest is so poor as well. You know, really, the only high-profile Italian rider at the current time is Vincenzo Nibali. His profile is not, certainly not stratospheric, and he's not going to be riding the Giro. And, you know, last week we had the controversy about the wildcard selections, and there was a lot of debate about whether the yellow fluo team, formerly Vini Fantini, deserved to take part. But it was a legitimate ethical debate to be had about that. But when you looked at their, you look at their roster, it is unbelievably poor. And that is really a reflection on kind of the general standard of Italian racing at the moment.
That's a recurring theme, isn't it? Daniel being very downbeat about Italian cycling. Poor Daniel. No, but well, speaking of Italian cycling and ethics, I don't know if we should also mention Alessandro Balan and Danilo De Luca, who have been in the news recently. Let's maybe return to that. Let's carry on with a bit of transfer. The other one is Mark Renshaw back to Cavendish's side at Omega Pharma. Are they going to? Is that chemistry going to be rekindled at Omega Pharma, do you think? Are they going to pick up where they left off at HTC?
I would. There's no reason why not. The issue is complicated, or maybe complicated slightly, by other new additions to that lead-out trend. Well, Pataki in particular, and then you've also got Stegmans. I can see being completely discarded from the lead-out trend. I don't think it worked particularly well last year. On paper, he's someone who could do the job. I just, with Renshaw coming in, I just don't think he will feature, and he probably shouldn't feature. So, you know, Pataki on paper as well might be as fast, he might be as, he certainly as experienced as Renshaw, could also do a job. But I think the smart thing and what will happen is that Renshaw will slot in as the lead out man, and Pataki could even come before Renshaw.
Any other transfers catch your eye, Lionel?
Well, Rui Costa, the world champion, to Lampre Merida. Be interesting to see what, you know, I'm assuming he will be riding the Tour de France as their main man, and
as a GC rider, you think?
Well, I would have thought, you know, he's sort of, he's top 10 material, isn't he, if everything goes his way. You know, he's hunted for stages in the past and he's been very good at it. Whether or not he wants to stay in contention and just ride around as a kind of one of those semi-anonymous faces in the top 10, will depend on a lot of factors, but you know he's certainly someone who could ignite the race if he went for stage.
Yeah, and I think we'd probably rather see him go for stage wins rather than finish eighth.
Well, yeah, that's all the perennial argument, isn't it? I mean, there's still the old school thinking that we were talking about before. You traditionally sort of places more value on finishing sixth or seventh and perhaps winning a stage. In some ways, it depends how the opening phase of the race goes, because if you lose time by misfortune, then the decision is made for you. But if somebody like Rui Costa gets through that first week and is around the sort of high places, and then as the mountains come, by default kind of rides himself into the top six or seven, then he's kind of landlocked. He's unable to make the moves that would get him a stage
landlocked,
win.
Landlocked, I like it.
So he would have to lose time, either through misfortune or semi-deliberately, in order to have that licence. Because I can't see any other way that he would be allowed that freedom.
But Lampre have won a race already this year.
I think they've got a good team this year. I mean, almost by default, they've just become the kind of sort of refuse
dumping ground.
Yeah, for anyone else who used to be in a half decent Italian team.
That takes us to Chris Horner, maybe. Well,
exactly.
Rumoured to be possibly joining Lampre. If he's going to end up in one World Tour team, perhaps Lampre is the
Place. I mean, there have been a few management changes, minor management changes there this year, and it does look slightly better set up. But going back to Rui Costa, I think he's treating this year, he signed a one-year contract, he's treating it as an experiment. He's saying that he's going to do 1 year, try to do the general classification in the Tour, and then it may be that this time next year he's in a different team, going back to a different style of racing. But I think if there is ever a year, again, a bit like what I said with the Giro, if ever there's a year to kind of have that experiment, it is this year in the Tour, because I think a lot could happen in the first week of the Tour de France, and, you know, we could see two or three theoretical contenders out of the race, I think, in the first week. I mean, out of contention, you know, with stages in Yorkshire, which could be quite complicated, and that there's a stage over the cobbles, and also a stage on the northern coast of France, which, you know, is susceptible to crosswinds, I think could be quite a hairy first week.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
We're going to finish off our first podcast of 2014. We're going to finish this one by each selecting one sort of story, stroke race, stroke rider that we're looking forward to following in 2014. Lionel.
Well, I am looking forward this year to the Spring Classics. I always look forward to the Spring Classics, but for some reason
I'm... Is that because you get to drink lots of Belgian beer, mainly?
Yeah, I mean, they're accessible.
The beers or the classics?
The beers are accessible. There's a real sort of a sense of kind of a building rhythm to the whole of the Spring, really. Once kind of Paris-Nice is out of the way, Tirreno Adriatico is out of the way, and you get to Milan San Remo, and then, you know, as we've talked before about Milan San Remo being almost a kind of metaphor for the entire classic season.
For life, some would say.
Basically, once you're over the top of the Poggio, it's downhill all the way.
I feel like I'm almost at the top of the Poggio. Yeah. I've been on that plateau for a while now.
I've kind of fallen off on the descent of the Cipressa, I think. But I love Milan-San Remo. Just because there's this kind of galloping sense of the race kind of getting away from you as it goes along. You can't quite tell what's happening until it's sort of happened, and then you're onto something else happening, and it's just that tightening of the of tension over the course of a sort of long afternoon. And then it all swings up to Belgium, and just those races, the Grand Prix, E3, Harald Becker, named after a motorway. I mean, you can't get more Belgian cycling than that.
I love that race.
Gent-Wevelgem, which has lost a little bit by being moved to a Sunday. It was much better when it was on a Wednesday between the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. But all of those races with the cold weather and the cobbles and the concrete roads and the pavements and riders diving left and right, and just those races have so much history. You watch, and I think this is where I struggle to.
They matter, don't they?
They matter. Yeah, you can look at the, whether it's the Quaremont or the Koppenberg or the you know, sections of Pavé in Paris-Roubaix, and you can remember multiple things that have really mattered that have happened on that stretch of road. And that is something that, despite all of the excitement and shiny newness of something like the Tour Down Under, you can't really say the same about Willunga
Hill. It's different, isn't it? Like, exactly the point, yeah. I mean, it's almost like entertainment Tour Down Under, whereas those kind of, inverted commas, small races in Belgium can you can see it, the roadside fans particularly, it matters to them. It's just a different culture.
There's something very reassuring about them as well. Like, you know, professional cycling is such a dynamic world, and it's constantly in flux, and they're the sort of terra firma. You know, it's the same. You can go every single year, and the fans look the same. The races kind of feels the same. Nothing really ever changes, and there's a sort of comfort in that, isn't there? Mm.
And then the character of the races just evolves and shifts as the months goes on, and you leave the cobbles behind, and then there's Chelles de Plaisse, which is kind of a semicolon in the middle of April, which is for the sprinters.
You mean
really.
A semi-classic?
Okay. It's a semi-classic semicolon before you then it's into the Ardennes for Flesh Wallonne and
what
Leo
kind of punctuation mark would you
say? Well, Kurt wouldn't have liked Chelles de Plaisse, and would he? He was big down on semicolons.
Well, yeah, and Liège-Bastogne-Liège
never won Chelles de Plaisse.
Liège-Bastogne-Liège is an exclamation mark,
and,
surely.
And paragraph break,
yeah.
And what's Flesh Wallonne then?
Oh, Flesh Wallonne is a typo. It was supposed to be a comma, but it's actually an M. I don't know. I like Flesh Wallonne.
I love Flesh Wallonne.
But we got very excited about the fact that all three of those races, Amstel Gold, Flesh Wallonne, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, all finished on top of a steep, and in the case of Flesh Wallonne, a very steep hill. But really, we've just got the same race served up to us three times in the space of a week. And I think when Amstel Gold then moved the finish, so it's over the top of the Coburg and then
massive
on the flat, huge improvement,
changed
the dynamic of the race completely. And I think that Flesh Will Own, you know, would be improved perhaps by finishing back down round the corner in the centre of Puy instead of on top of the
Flesh Will Own. Maybe it's a question mark then.
And also, for me, the finish of Flesh Will Own is too picturesque. It needs to finish somewhere grottier, because if you go back in history and you look at where Flesh Will Own used to go, it was basically a tour of the crappiest towns in Belgium. Yeah. It was really awful.
People obviously always sort of talk about the Ardennes being this kind of wonderful picturesque place, but actually
it's absolute grot.
Yeah, slag maybe this is where the new cycling is going wrong, that there's this quest to take it through the picturesque parts of the world, where actually they should go the other way. Mind you, Tour Qatar and maybe Tour Britain as well are perhaps not always.
Yeah, but I mean, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, I was going to ask Daniel a little bit about it, because Italy has got
a fascinating... It sounds beautiful, doesn't it, Liège-Bastogne-Liège?
Yeah.
But it's not.
Got a fascinating relationship with the race, the Italian, because the immigrant moved up to work in the mines, and there's quite an expat Italian... community there, but some of the roads are, you know, it's compared to Flanders, which is quite a wealthy region. The Ardennes region of Belgium is quite run down, quite poor. It doesn't look the best, but yet the race has a kind of a beauty, simply because those roads are so steep.
There is beauty in ugliness.
Exactly.
Final.
Exactly.
Daniel,
can we go to you first?
Well, I'm okay. It's a small thing, really, but I'm quite curious to see a BMC fair this year. I think they've been the largest funded and most underachieving team of the last few years. They got rid of Jean Lalanne after the tour last year. Alan Piper's in charge now. Bobby Julius there, Marco Pinotti as well, is obviously on the coaching staff there. Just for time trials, isn't it, really, his role. But they've got an enormous staff team still, and they've still got a roster of very well-paid riders, from Taylor Finney to Philippe Gilbert. Not Alessandro Balan anymore, obviously, they've lost him. But, you know, I think this should be the season when they start finally...
It's time for Finney to kick on, isn't it?
It is, actually,
especially in the classics.
Yeah, especially in the classics. I mean, he was in fine form in Qatar last year, looked so, so strong, and didn't really deliver on that in the classics. And you look at races like Paris-Roubaix, and, you know, this could be the year as well, he rides the Tour de France finally, and he will no doubt fancy that cobbled stage at the Tour de France as well. But Gilbert, you know, he's on another 3-year deal, isn't he, with BMC. You know, I think Piper is the right man to shake things up there, but they've still got a real problem with some of the personnel. You know, they've got Cadel Evans still talking about going back to Tour and trying to contend again. TJ Van Garderen would be the logical kind of leader of the team there, despite his performance last year. So I think it's a big year for BMC, and I'll be watching with interest.
What interests me about BMC is there doesn't seem to be any kind of... Maybe there is privately, but there doesn't seem to ever be an inquest into their performance the way that Sky and Garmin Sharp and some of the other teams would take away from... take away from a poor year or poor performance and implement some kind of way to rectify things. I mean, Gilbert just looks like a rider who's being paid a lot of money and being allowed to drift, and you couldn't imagine that in another sort of team sport. You know, if you've got a highly paid asset, you know, in a football team who isn't performing, then, you know, you get dropped, or you're transferred to another club, or there doesn't seem to be any consequence to not performing.
You could say the consequence was Jean Lalonde going, because apparently there was a personality clash between Gilbert and Lalonde, and again, you know, the Lalonde perhaps wasn't the right guy to direct the team, but it's an odd response to Gilbert underperforming to get rid of the director. Although I'd question Lalonde's track record as well, not just with BMC but Phonak as well.
Yeah, I mean, Lionel, I think there's no inquest, because it's basically a vanity project for Andy Reese, the team, and you know, there's no real uncertainty about where the money's coming from next year. It's just that, you know, Andy Reese, I think, is in it for the long haul, and I think he just enjoys his contact with the team. He enjoys spending time with the riders.
Isn't that fear?
He enjoys inviting them to his chateau at the foot of the Mont Ventoux and quaffing a bit of, you know, his home-produced Rouge, and I think he's fairly happy with that. And
well, the level of investment in the team dwarfs the amount of money BMC Bicycles makes, doesn't it? So, you know, in terms of sort of profit of the company, the expenditure on the team is, you know, out of proportion.
Really. Out of proportion, yeah. Daniel.
Well, Rich, I'm going to give you all a good laugh. What do you think I'm going to say?
I think you're going to probably say that the thing you're most looking forward to this year is watching young French cyclists.
Bing!
Young Frenchmen.
Well, it's funny
on bike.
You should say that, Rich. Funny you should say that, Rich. Not in a homoerotic kind of way, but just because it's a story that I've been following for a few years.
We're all friends.
Very excited to see, you know, the usual suspects I always talk about: Warren Barguil, Romain Bardet, and particularly Thibaut Pinot. Now, I spoke at length last year, didn't I, about his problems descending. I actually went to an Arsenal game with his brother a couple of weeks ago, who's also his coach. So we were talked a bit about what's happened since last year's tour, as regards to Thibaut's descending. Now, he, as you'll probably all remember, he completely lost his nerve in the Pyrenees last year, and after a brilliant first ride in the Tour de France in 2012, had an absolute disaster last year, pulled out early. He came back into form at the Vuelta, rode a good World Championships, but yeah, a lot of question marks obviously about him this year and whether he'll be able to kind of conquer his demons descending. They've tried all sorts since the Tour. He's been doing testing in rally cars at Magny-Cours. He's done some kind of ice rally at Alpe d'Huez, where he had to ride around
has
an ice.
Has he ridden his bike at all this winter? Yeah.
He's been taking his ride from advice from Alex Stader. Is it Stader or Stader?
Alex Stader, yeah,
a former Tour de France rider,
yeah, and who's a speed skater as well,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah, who's
was
an
he,
old.
Was he Alex Stader? Am I getting confused? I know Eric Hayden obviously was, but it was Alex Stader.
He was the first Canadian, wasn't he?
Alex Stader was the first North American ever to wear the yellow jersey in 1986.
Yeah, and he's been taking advice from him about descending, and it's really with Pinot, it's really a question of speed. It's not a lot of people were surprised by how well he rode at the World Championships on tricky, kind of treacherous roads, when people like Bradley Wiggins will find it very difficult. And the reason for that was that it was actually quite slow on the descents of the World Championships because it was raining, because it was so dangerous. So he doesn't have a problem with that. He kind of has a problem when it's a very
fast, straight
descent, and he just completely loses his nerve. So it would be a shame if that problem sabotaged what is obviously
considerable. What about young Kenny Ellison, the small Frenchman on Francis de Jure, who was a real revelation at Tour de Man last year?
Yeah, kind of matchbox.
Yeah.
Climber, it's tiny, I think about 160 centimetres, about
small,
five, six. I think he's going to be a very good climber. I think there are always going to be limitations for a rider as small as that in on the flat and in time trials. I don't see him as being someone who'll contend in future in major tours.
No.
I mean, the one who I think could really explode this year and already did at the end of last year was Barguil for what is now the Giant team. I mean, the way he rode at the Vuelta, won two stages at the Vuelta, and just made it look very, very easy. And I think he's a massive talent.
Arnaud Démare as well. I mean, they've got a very strong team of Francis Desjardins, haven't they? They've got a lot of winners in inverted commas. There are a lot of guys who are capable of
they've got
attacking and winning races.
Yeah, and a lot of talented young guys. You know, even Alfredo, who has come back from a doping battle. A doping violation.
Administrative.
Yeah, having missed three tests. He could fare well in the classics. And Madio has been talking up Demar's potential to win Paris-Roubaix and Tour of Flanders at some point in the future. So,
wow.
You know, we think of him more as a sprinter at the moment, but I think he will ride the classics this year, and it'll be interesting to see.
And Alfredo's fit in those races as
well. Yeah. So I think the French, that, you know, to kind of sum up, they've really, it's been kind of a long process, this regaining their confidence, having kind of been the whipping boys for years, and I really think that now, more than ever, we saw it at the end of last year, they've really kind of emancipated themselves, and you know, they will be one of the strongest nations this year.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
Well, that's us for the first Humans Invent Cycling podcast of 2014. Daniel, thank you very much.
Cheerio. Talking of cheerio, cheerio.
Cheerio, cheerio. Is he in Argentina at the moment? Or
he's being very shifty at the moment. He might be in Argentina, he might
be
in Australia.
He was in California for a bit, wasn't he?
I was texting him yesterday, but he wouldn't disclose his whereabouts.
Ciro Scognamiglio will be back on the podcast very, very soon. I know he's really looking forward to it.
We really need to get him to fill in a whereabouts form, don't we?
We do.
I'd like to know where he is at all times.
We need his whereabouts. Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard. And here's to a successful year's podcasting.
Yeah, we'll be back next week. Thank you for listening.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.